As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
I told you, I'm the champion of the world. All of you bow. All of my critics crawl. All of you suckers who write the Ring magazine. Boxing knows there. All of you suckers bow. Come to Muhammad Ali. I am the man.
I am the greatest.
Someone with power. Someone with power. Someone with fear.
Ali's got a left, Ali's got a right. If he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. And as you lie on the floor while the bell counts 10, hope and pray that you never meet me again.
I am the greatest.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Jordan Heath Rawlings. Listen, we'll get to lots in the next couple of hours. Blue Jays, of course, continuing their incredible run through the Yankees and Red Sox. Raptors offseason going along swimmingly right now with Dwayne Casey receiving a contract extension, plus Stanley Cup Finals continuing as the series shifts to San Jose. But clearly the news of the day, the news of the week, news of the year is one of the icons of North American sports passing away. Muhammad Ali on Friday dying at the age of 74. We'll have our own discussion about one of the greatest of all time, but who better to encapsulate the life of Muhammad Ali than Stephen Brunt?
Cassius Marcellus Clay was born on January 17, 1942, in rigidly segregated Louisville, Kentucky. In those early days, Clay was a gangly prankster, but it was a fit of anger that changed the course of his life. In 1954, Clay took his new red and white Schwinn bicycle to the annual fair of the Louisville Service Club. When he came outside, his bike had been stolen. Angry and scared of his father's reaction, he went to the basement of a nearby gym to report the theft. A policeman named Joe Martin taught boxing. Clay told Martin that he intended to whoop the culprit as soon as he found him. Martin suggested he might want to learn to fight first. It was in that basement gym that Clay discovered he could make magic with his fists and his feet. He erupted onto the public spotlight in 1960, winning the gold medal in the light heavyweight division at the Rome Olympics, and turned pro immediately after.
As you know, today is the jet age. Everybody's trying to break records. Man says that he'll be on the moon by 1970. One man said that they're going to make cars that'll run by sunlight. Well, those are pretty game predictions. Well, I predicted I'd be the heavyweight champion by the time I'm 21.
He quickly tore a swath through the heavyweight division, boldly predicting his opponent's fate.
Well, Henry Cooper's nothing but a tramp. He's a bum. I'm the world's greatest. He must fall in five rounds, but if you talk about me, I'll cut it three.
I saw Sonny Liston a few days ago, Cash.
Ain't he ugly? He's too ugly to be the world's champ. The world's champ should be pretty like me.
Well, he told me to bet my life that you wouldn't go three rounds.
Well, if you want to lose your money, then bet on Sonny.
Clay won his first 19 pro fights, but to fulfill his goal of becoming heavyweight champion, the 22-year-old had one colossal mountain to climb. Sonny Liston, who was thought to be unbeatable.
I don't care how small the ring is, I'll fight that chump in a telephone booth.
I honestly want me to tell this to your camera, your TV man, your radio man, and you right there in the whole world. If Sonny Liston looks at me, I'll kiss his feet in the rain. I'm not out of the rain on my knees.
When the two met for the title in February 1964, Liston was the prohibitive favorite, but Clay acted like anything but an underdog. Clay made good on his boasts, dominating Liston, who retired on his stool following the sixth round.
They might be stopping it. That might be all, ladies and gentlemen. Get up there, Joe. Get up there. Get up in the ring. Bedlam busting out here.
Oh, great. I don't have a mark on my face.
Yeah.
And I upset Sonny Liston, and I just turned 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world. I talk to God every day. If God's with me, can't nobody be against me, Sonny. I shut up the world. Oh, I'm the king of the world.
Hold it.
I'm pretty.
Hold it. You're not that pretty.
I'm a bad man. I shook up the world. I shook up the world.
Wait a minute, Cash. Wait a minute.
You must listen to me.
The next day, the new champion shed the name Cassius Clay and announced he had joined the Nation of Islam, led by Elijah Muhammad, a man many Americans viewed as a dangerous extremist. Muhammad and his protege Malcolm X rejected integration and the civil rights movement while advocating racial separatism. They vowed to achieve that goal by any means necessary.
Why do you insist on being called Muhammad Ali now?
That's the name given to me by my leading teacher, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. That's my original name. That's a black man name. Cassius Clay was my slave name. I'm no longer a slave.
What does it mean?
Muhammad means worthy of all praises, and Ali means most high.
Muhammad Ali had become a powerful symbol of the unrest swirling around America during a time of racial tensions, social upheaval, and the Vietnam War. While his image outside the ring became more complicated, his ascendancy as a boxer accelerated. In 1966, the United States Army declared Ali eligible to be drafted for service in Vietnam. Citing his religious beliefs and America's continued mistreatment of blacks, Ali declared that he would not serve. "I ain't got no quarrel with the Viet Cong," he declared. "No Viet Cong ever called me nigger.
I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now, right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemies are white people, not Viet Congs or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home."
In April 1967, Ali defiantly refused induction.
"When a registrant refuses this first step, when his name is called, he is quietly removed from the room. He is counseled as to the seriousness of his refusal. He is given the penalties, the maximum legal penalties that this act could result in."
"This would mean that you stand the chance of going to jail as a result of not going into service."
"Well, whatever the punishment, whatever the persecution is for standing up for my religious beliefs, even if it means facing machine gun fire that day, I will face it before denouncing Elijah Muhammad and the religion of Islam."
That same day, he was stripped of his title and banned from boxing.
"I want the world and the cameras to hear. Who's the heavyweight champion of the world? One more time, we don't want no excuses. They may say the film was bad or the camera was broke. One more time, who's the champion of the world?"
Ali was initially vilified for his stand, at least as much as he was celebrated. But by 1970, public opinion had turned against the war. Some still considered him a draft dodger, but many others acknowledged his courage in the face of persecution while standing up for his beliefs. Ali got his boxing license back in 1970 and immediately became the top contender to fight Joe Frazier, who had claimed the heavyweight title during Ali's exile.
"I predict that when I meet Joe Frazier, this will be like a good amateur fighting a real professional. This will be like a kid out of the Olympics meeting the fastest heavyweight champion that ever lived. This will be no contest.
You're not fighting Oscar Bonavera. You're not fighting Sonny Liston. You fighting Joe Frazier.
Well, everybody knows that's not the point.
That's the point.
Yo, what's your prediction?
My prediction, the fight wouldn't go the distance.
Oh, won't
I'll
go the
stop
distance.
It. Stop me. You.
Joe's going to come out smoking, and I ain't going to be joking. I'll be pecking and a poking, pouring water on his smoking. Then this might shock and amaze you, but I will destroy Joe Frazier."
They called it the fight of the century, and it lived up to its billing, though it was clear that Ali had lost a step during his 3 years away. Frazier floored him with a left hook in the 14th round, en route to a unanimous decision victory. 3 months after losing to Frazier, Ali won an even bigger fight when the Supreme Court overturned his conviction for refusing induction. His legal shackles had been removed, but ring rust continued to corrode as he lost to lightly regarded Ken Norton. In the meantime, Frazier had lost his title to George Foreman, which set up a second Allie Frazier bout, this time to determine the number one contender. Allie avenged his loss to Frazier and earned another shot at reclaiming the title unjustly taken from him 7 years before. That quest took him to Kinshasa, Zaire, where he faced a much younger, much bigger, and apparently unbeatable champion, George Foreman.
And Ali is getting the people to chant, Ali Boumaye. That means Ali kill him.
So the stage is set. We're just about ready to begin. Round one. The championship is at stake. Ali ready, Foreman ready. We're waiting for the opening bell.
Ali shocked the world, using the now famous rope-a-dope strategy, leaning back on the ropes and covering up to absorb Foreman's mighty blows. Ali knocked out the exhausted and frustrated champion in the eighth round. Fight with old rival Joe Frazier in Manila in 1975 cemented Ali's legacy. It was one of the most brutal fights in boxing history, with all of Frazier's personal animosity towards Ali spilling out into the ring.
Frazier teed off on Ali now with the right hand. Ali will probably open up all of a sudden. Frazier looks awful tired. Is puffed around both eyes now. Ali has gone out for a knockout, I think, in this round. Frazier is hurt.
Ali finally secured the victory, and Frazier's corner threw in the towel before the final round, with Ali himself barely able to get off his stool.
He is tough. He's a great fighter.
First round.
I'm so tired, I don't want to do nothing.
The thrill in Manila may have been the greatest triumph for Muhammad Ali, the boxer, but it also began the final tragic act of his career. In 1978, Ali lost his title to lightly regarded Leon Spinks. He reclaimed it in a rematch 7 months later, but the once hyper-articulate champion was now struggling with an occasional stutter and shaky hands. Still, following a brief retirement, he returned to the ring to fight Larry Holmes in October 1980. Ali absorbed a terrible beating, and the fight was mercifully stopped after the 10th round. He would fight one last time, losing to Canadian Trevor Berbick in 1981. The blows he absorbed over a 21-year career took their toll. In 1984, Ali was diagnosed with Parkinson's syndrome, a condition that can be the result of head trauma. Ali shook up the world one last time, making a surprise appearance to light the Olympic cauldron at the Atlanta Games. His hands trembled. The voice that had once boomed loud enough to convert an entire generation to his cause had been nearly silenced. And that face, once so expressive, had frozen into a weathered mask. Disease and the damage wrought by the sport which he had transformed robbed him of so much. But even physically diminished, Ali remained a transcendent figure, crossing lines of race, religion, politics, and culture as no other athlete has. Bigger than any game, more famous for much of his life than any other person on earth. Muhammad Ali, champion boxer, civil rights crusader, hero to millions around the world, and forever the greatest.
That again, Stephen Brunt, like you needed to be told that. Back inside our Toronto studios here, Sportsnet Magazine Live, I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Craig Battle. Gents, it's I want to tackle this from a couple of different sides of it, obviously. We live in a very different era than the one in which Muhammad Ali was a transcendent sports star. And I do want to bring it back to current day sports. But let's try to reflect as we can as guys who did not live through the heyday of Muhammad Ali, but certainly consuming as much sports and reading as much as we have about the man and hearing what guys like Stephen Brunt say about him. It's incredible what he did.
It's amazing. And I mean, just listening to that documentary and those quotes and those clips, and you know, we tend to reflect on moments in his life, and we've done it sort of for the last few decades. But then when you listen to it sort of all packed one after the other, and just everything that he accomplished and everything that he meant to so many people, that's the thing that's really stood out to me this morning. I mean, everybody from across the world, from President Obama to just young sports fans who have heard about him from their dads and grandfathers, it's an achievement that I don't know that any athlete will ever make.
To me, he was just the most unique person, the most unique athlete that we've ever seen. I mean, his feet were fast, and yet he was a big man, and he could hit hard, and he could take a punch, but also like out of the ring, you know, he was a fly by the seat of his pants poet, and you know, he was a trash talker, and he could be humble, and he could be friendly, and you get him in front of a mic, and he's this total intense speaker. He can, you know, he was all over the place. In that sort of cliche way, he contained multitudes. You know, he was a lot of different things, and he wound up being a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Sort of the perfect athlete, the perfect controversial figure, and like you said, it was a much different era.
Well, it was a much different era on a couple of different fronts. One, like, we don't find the biggest stars in sports in boxing anymore. Like, there is a couple of guys, but certainly boxing has kind of, society's passed it by in large part. We find the biggest stars in sports probably in the NFL, in the NBA, in this country, hockey players, and in Major League Baseball. But it's also a different world socially and politically. And I'm not talking necessarily about Canada, but the United States. Like, certainly there were so many things going on, and we're talking about like lives in danger. We're talking about a Vietnam draft. That was a large part of the Stephen Brunt essay that we just heard. And I try to make the comparison to today's athlete, and you try and find the guy who's like most like Muhammad Ali, or where have we gone as far as being outspoken politically and socially. And it seems that whenever anyone tries to get to that point, there's a big pushback. And I know hindsight we can only evaluate Muhammad Ali in hindsight because we didn't live through it. But at the time, like, he was a very polarizing character.
It was. And there's a lot of pushback. There's a lot of pushback to athletes speaking out like that today. And so we sit here and say, well, nobody's like Ali anymore because nobody speaks out because of all the pushback. But I mean, he had the ultimate pushback. Yeah. He was sent to jail. He was vilified as a traitor. You know, the legacy of Ali that sports heroes today don't live up to. And I don't mean to sound like they don't try, because they do speak up and they do get their message out and make their points heard. But Ali spoke up when it was really, really hard, when there were real consequences. He lost his title. He lost his freedom. And yeah, athletes today make political statements, and good for them when they do it. But I can't see an athlete today with multi-millions of dollars to lose speaking up in the way that he did and risking losing absolutely everything.
Because athletes today get vilified for the most, you know, innocuous of things. You know, we go back to a couple of years back when Richard Sherman has the tit-for-tat with Michael Crabtree in a playoff game. after the playoff game, Richard Sherman shuts him down. He's talking to the on-field reporter, and he essentially says, you know, don't ever talk about me like that. You know, I'm the best cornerback in the league. And he does it in a pretty vociferous way to a reporter on field. And after the game, he's just murdered for being, oh, well, he's trying to be bigger than the game. He's not humble. He's not a sportsman. You know, that isn't anything controversial. But people, a lot of people, especially sort of on social media and stuff like that, really want their athletes to fit in a box and to speak a certain way and to treat the game, you know, especially in sort
and
of-
it's funny because that trash talk was probably one of the best trash talk incidents of the last few years in terms of like just the way he went about it. You know, you try sure. me with a sorry ass receiver like Crabtree. That's sure. what you're going to get. It was fun. It was good. And then you listen to that doc and it's like, it's not even in the same class as Ali's trash talking.
No, and it's not unique in that way. You know, he didn't write a poem afterwards and sort of, you know, imagine if Richard Sherman had written a poem of Michael Crabtree and came out after the fact. Like,
it's hard to rhyme with Crabtree.
Yeah, it's a little tough. We can by the end of the show, we'll have it. But no, people would be, you know, he would get made fun of mercilessly and, you know, it would affect his endorsements and his free agency deals. And, you know, his handlers would be, you know, shaking their heads and wringing their hands.
I just wonder if there weren't the same dissenters that we saw to Richard Sherman, that there were the same dissenters to Muhammad Ali. There just was no means of communication. There was no 24-hour news cycle. There was no Twitter. Not everybody had a microphone in front of their faces.
Those dissenters existed. And yeah. I mean, it was a large part of white America that was dissenting at the time that he was avoiding the draft and saying those things about the Viet Cong and the American troops. But, you know, we live in an echo chamber to a certain extent now because of social media, where the loudest, most annoying voices, you know, are the ones that we see the most. And you didn't have that back then. So I think in a sense, and again, I wasn't alive back then, but it seems like that might have made it easier for an athlete to just speak out and not have to hear or see every little response to it.
Right. And I'm thinking about, like, I take that point, Ben. Imagine Muhammad Ali in the Twitter era.
Oh my gosh.
It would just, and how much maybe that would affect him, and that would, you know, how his handlers would be like, maybe you got to step back on these types of things and that kind of thing. If you're getting, you know, killed daily on Twitter and there's people sort of mounting like, you know, social media campaigns against your abilities and stuff like that. Yeah, and groupthink and, you know, sort of, it's possible that gets in your head eventually.
Yeah, and imagine that and that echo chamber in a world in which Ali stood to lose tens of million dollars in Nike endorsements and watch endorsements, which were not a big part of an athlete's income back when he was doing that. You know, now if LeBron goes out and says something that he really believes that's incendiary to half of America, he's at risk of losing half of his income, which is a huge thing for him to undertake now. So I think just because of how big sports has become and how much money is at stake, there's a natural barrier for athletes doing that.
Right. And in terms of performance too, I mean, you brought up LeBron. LeBron gets, you know, criticized every time he loses in the finals, whereas, you know, people point out, hey, you know, he got to the finals. That's an accomplishment. We're spinning this sort of thing. And because it is a 24-hour news cycle, people are always looking for angles. Imagine, so Ali in that Brunt documentary, he lost to Burbick, he lost to Spinks, he lost to Norton, he lost to Frazier. Would today's news cycle treat Muhammad Ali like this massive failure because he lost these big fights?
Can Ali get it done?
Can Ali get it done?
Up next.
You know, is Ali clutch? You know, like, can he come through in the moment? I feel like... because of the way we react to so many things. I mean, Foreman had a hard time after he lost to Ali in the Rumble in the Jungle. He went away for 2 years. Does Foreman ever even come back if he has to fight against the weight of hot takes that are piling up against him?
And here's the beautiful thing. I mean, I think that we take away from every time we go in depth and look at what Muhammad Ali was actually like and what he actually did is that I honestly think he would have been immune to that stuff. Like, you look at the way he treated the criticism that he got, which was intense. You look at the way, you know, he treated the hate that he got, or even that he treated the boxers that he was fighting against. You know, he didn't hold anything back. And I think that's part of the reason that we revere him so much.
Well, and athletes today are like little mini corporations, right? It's not just the athlete you're talking about. There's livelihoods outside of them that are at stake for every wrong move. There's
dozens of family members relying on them now.
Yeah, and... was it the case for Muhammad Ali? Maybe to a degree, but...
But he made his money in the ring, fighting. Mm-hmm, and if he kept winning and beating guys, he would continue to make a living, which is different now in that, like, you know, LeBron will continue to make his salary from the NBA.
Sure.
But the corporation that is LeBron now doesn't just depend on that.
Well, back to your previous point as well, like, okay, there's a lot of money on the line, and certainly that's an inhibitor to athletes speaking their minds and speaking out against the groupthink and maybe social issues. Muhammad Ali's life was on the line when he spoke out. So, there was not money at stake, but there was, like, personal freedoms. There was an actual life on the line
and that's
when he
why
spoke
he's,
out.
That's why he's a hero. Just like an athlete that's an actual social hero. Mm-hmm. And that's why he gets that title. And almost nobody else in the business of sports does, because he did it at personal risk to himself and stood up for the root causes of what he believed in justice and freedom. And, you know, these are big words that we don't use talking about athletes today. And that just speaks to how huge he was.
Well, and I think the sport in which he used as his platform aided to that as well, because it's an individual sport, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if he's just a member of a team and he's a guy, even if he's the best player, even if it's LeBron James on a team.
And a sport in which you take punishment and deal punishment. Like, it's a visceral, physical, heart, guts.
You can trash talk and you can put it all on you, because it's only you that has to answer for that. If you're Richard Sherman and you add bulletin board material to that other team, maybe some of your teammates are going to look at you cross-eyed and just say, let's just play this game.
Right.
Let's not worry about the other stuff. If you're a boxer, if you're in an individual sport like boxing, it's a different situation where you can call out the opposition with a little bit of trash talk, because you know it's only you that has to answer for it in the ring. But once again, Muhammad Ali dying at the age of 74 on Friday, and plenty of tributes, I'm sure, all weekend, all next week, as just an icon, not just of sports, but really when you think about the biggest personalities, biggest images in North America.
What a human being.
Yeah, it's incredible. Over the last 100 years or so, the names that he's alongside, the guys that are most recognizable, he's top five for sure. We got more show to come as we're going to get into some sports of interest to people here in Toronto as well. We'll get to the Blue Jays after the top of the hour. But when we come back, Raptors into their offseason, and one of the big question marks has been answered. Dwayne Casey given a contract extension. What's next for the Raptors, and can the Cavs bounce back after their Game 1 loss in Golden State to the Warriors? Well, if you go by recent history and LeBron in games after losing Game 1, the answer might surprise you. That's coming up next. Ben Ennis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Craig Battle at Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Christina Rutherford.
Aaron Sanchez actually likes it when his mom comes to games with a giant cardboard cutout of his head. He weighs himself every day. And the Toronto Blue Jays right-hander swears he never gets sick of his roommate, Marcus Stroman. We sat down for a chat in the dugout with Sanchez for the interview. We talked about a whole bunch of stuff, including his arm, his off-season transformation, the time the button popped off his pants, oh, it did, his family, and more. He's a real celebrity in his hometown of Barstow, California. Did you know his name is on a water tower there?
Kind of growing up, we had a cross-country team that won, like, the state finals, like, 2 years in 4 years, like, just going before high school, and they have a water tower that kind of goes through town, and it recognized them. So kind of growing up, that was always been my dream of, like, I want my name on the water tower if I ever make it to the big leagues. And I don't know if it's actually on that one, but there is one on a water tower in town.
Wow.
That recognizes me, so it's pretty cool.
You made it.
I made it.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Hey, it's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis, Jordan Heath Rawlings, and Craig Battle. Let's talk a little NBA, shall we? Raptors with the greatest season in franchise history, both regular season and postseason-wise, 56 wins during the regular season. You make it to a conference final. You send it to a game six against LeBron James and the Cavaliers. Nothing to be upset about. It teetered. Like, it took a couple of game sevens to get to that place. They got there. And it's resulted in a contract extension for the head coach, Dwayne Casey. Still lots of question marks surrounding this team this offseason. DeMar DeRozan, of course, is going to opt out of his deal, become an unrestricted free agent. They got that ninth overall pick upcoming in the NBA draft. Bunch of young players. A lot of moving pieces. It's going to be a real interesting offseason. But let's maybe start with the one thing we do know. Dwayne Casey coming back. And a situation, Craig, I would think, there's only one move here. And Masai Ujiri made it pretty well known at his exit interview that Dwayne Casey was coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you said, this has been the best season for the Raptors. They made the third round. They won two games against a really tough team. And up until those two games, Cleveland really looked like a juggernaut. Like, they were absolutely on the level of the Golden State Warriors. So those two games really showed that, yeah, like, this team can make adjustments and can do things against really tough teams, and that maybe they're not as far away as they looked at certain points in the first and second rounds. And that's a lot to do with what Dwayne Casey has done with this team. He's fostered great relationships with players. He's gotten improvement out of DeRozan and Lowry and even Jonas Valanciunas. Sort of mid-season there was, should they trade Jonas for something else and move Bismack Biyombo up because we're going to need to pay him in the offseason? And Jonas really made a bunch of strides towards the end of the season. They were finding him in, like, advantageous places, and he looked dominant in the first seven, eight games, whatever, of the playoffs. And I think, yeah, like, again, that's all on Dwayne Casey, or a lot of it's on Dwayne Casey and the relationships he forges with the team. He's been criticized. I mean, you know, no coach doesn't get criticized, but I think he sort of addressed those things as they came along, and he got his team to compete and got them in the third round. I think there's a lot to like about what he's done with this team.
I agree. And yeah, what you're talking about, X's and O's and occasionally coming out of timeouts. And that used to be more of a thing, I want to say, with Dwayne Casey, certainly end of quarter possessions. I think the bigger pushback that comes to Dwayne Casey these days is, yeah, you got a couple of all-stars in the backcourt. But when they're not going good, they don't look for other options as much as maybe they could. Like, Jonas Valanciunas, especially during that Pacers series, occasionally looked like he was a beast. And you know, a lot of the offense could go through him and you'd be better off, and he was shooting a great percentage. I mean, he was 7-9, he was 7-8, seemingly every time he took the floor in that series. And still you had DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry, who were shooting horrible percentages, shooting, you know, 18, 20 times a game. I mean, that's the one. But, I mean, how much does a head coach have an impact on that kind of stuff? Well, we saw the same thing in Oklahoma City.
That's the kind of thing that great players have to be allowed to do, you know, to get themselves in a rhythm and get themselves to a position where they can take over games. Now, I mean, I think part of what Dwayne Casey has done really well in Toronto is establishing that relationship, like Craig said, with Lowry and with DeRozan. I mean, Kyle Lowry was a guy who
coach was killer.
Known as a coach killer before he got here. And now, I mean, you see him and Casey chatting on the bench, and they're really in sync. They're really working well together. And, you know, DeMar DeRozan seems intensely loyal to this guy, seems intensely loyal to the city. And, you know, Casey has gone away from them at times slightly. He benched DeRozan a little bit in the playoffs when DeRozan was struggling, yep. and that seemed to work well. But, I mean, I think a big part of what this team did together, and I think if you ask anybody who was around them and covering the team, was that they all fought together, right? They all fought for the same goals. They had each other's backs, and it's something you hear about in a winning clubhouse. And part of the cost for that, I think, is sometimes you have to allow your stars a longer leash to do what they do.
Yeah, and I don't know that Casey is the type of player-friendly coach that just rolled over for his players. And it's not like he just sort of said, okay, you guys do what you want to do, and I'm good, and they love him for the freedom. I feel like he is tough on them when it's warranted. And certainly he does, you know, give them a lot of freedom. And, you know, we've talked about it before where, yeah, like the Raptors have 10 seconds left on the clock and they're running it up, and then they dribble for 9 seconds and then put up a fadeaway three, which no other team really seems to do on the consistent basis. And so there's moments where you'd like to see more creativity, but it shows up. Like, it shows up in out of timeout plays occasionally. And I think there is just sort of like, he's developed a good relationship with these guys where he's put a lot of faith in them. And then occasionally they just don't deliver, but that's not on the coach every time. They've got options. They've got hitches in the offense where they could take it and dribble it and stuff like that. And I think that's sort of something that you talk about and something that they would want to work on moving forward. It's not something that Casey's super satisfied with.
And I think you'll see now that this, it seems like the roles are in place right now. Mm-hmm. You know, for the first time in a while, there was some flux in the lineup. There was a lot of, at the beginning of the season even, you know, who's going to be in the starting lineup? How's this going to break down? How are the minutes going to shake out? And I think as we went further, and I mean, injuries played a little bit of a role as well, but I think as we went further in the season and into the playoffs, you really started to see players playing with their defined roles. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, if you keep the structure intact, you keep the coach intact, you bring the players back, that's the kind of thing that can hold over. And then from there, you can start getting into, okay, what do we run at this time? We know which personnel will be on the floor. We know that, you know, DeRozan likes to look for Valanciunas in this situation, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the kind of thing that cohesiveness and time can bring to a good team.
Yeah, consistency is huge, and you see it every year. The teams that are carrying over much of the same roster that have the same head coach get off to better starts than mm-hmm. teams that are trying to figure it out. We saw it a couple of years ago with that Cavs team with LeBron returning, that they got off to a real rough start because they just trying to figure it out. It seems that the Raptors will have some sort of consistency headed into next season. Yeah. What does that mean for DeMar DeRozan? I imagine that... And there'll be plenty of time to break this down this summer and second guess and try and figure out the next move. But, and there were moments where, I mean, man, it's amazing to imagine where our thinking has gone in like a month and a half with DeMar DeRozan, because it, at the end of the regular season, was no brainer. You got to re-sign him, max money. He's a max player. He's an elite player. He's an all-star. He deserved all the accolades headed his way. Boy, I mean, you look at the body of work in the postseason, he still shot a very poor percentage, like historically low for the number of shots he took. But there were times where he carried that team, needed his performance. I know it was volume shooting in Game 7 against the Pacers. Raptors don't win that game without him.
No. Yeah, it got the job done. And, I mean, in a sense, it's the same thing that the Blue Jays faced after last season, which is after a period of not having any success, which for the Raptors was really their entire franchise history. You know, you get further than you have in a very long time, and everybody's excited, and you're under pressure. Not to say that GMs give into this pressure ever, because they don't often, but there's a lot of public pressure for you to keep that team exactly intact, whether or not it's the best thing for it. You know, we saw it with the outrage of David Price signing a huge deal with the Red Sox that is probably not a smart baseball deal, but there was still pressure for the Jays to keep him just because look at the season you had. How can you not bring these guys back? And I think DeRozan is in a similar boat. He's obviously a lot younger and there's more upside, but it's a similar kind of thing in that it might be better for the Raptors if they were able to find another free agent option that's a more consistent player that doesn't rely on volume shooting. But the optics of it wouldn't be good after having the best season in franchise history.
No, and I think that's the thing is that, yeah, like you can sort of like in your head create the sort of like the model player that you're like, okay, well, yeah, maybe someone who can create his own shot but doesn't shoot the same volume, maybe someone who's
also rebound. If he could rebound and block shots, that would be great.
And he was 8 feet tall.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
But he could dribble.
Yeah, it's like NBA Live, you know, create a player. It's like, yeah, let's, you know. Anyway, but that doesn't really necessarily get you anywhere. And then finding that player is a totally different thing. Like giving your idea, like, oh, yeah, we would love to be able to pay this guy $10 million instead of the $25 million that DeRozan's going to get. We like to be perfect. But when you start looking around the league, two guard is one of the shallowest positions that the league has. It's like you've got Klay Thompson and James Harden in some order, and then it's basically like DeRozan, and then you're down to like Bradley Beal, and then it just drops off a cliff, right? Like, it's not a position where you're going to go, we'll just get the next best guy, because that guy's getting overpaid too.
So you're looking at bringing up Powell or somebody like that and starting them.
Exactly. You're hoping that Powell develops and you know, he can be a nice backup, and then maybe If Terrence Ross isn't part of the future plans, then maybe you're turning his $10 million contract into something else, and then you save money elsewhere on the roster. But, like, in their press conference, in Masai's press conference the other day, he was talking about the needs for the team, and he came up with power forward, which we've been talking about for a year. And you look through the league, and that guy doesn't really exist either. You want a defender and who can also switch a screen and protect the rim and shoot a three maybe, or at least almost three-point range. And those guys are just so few and far between. You get like a sort of a Serge Ibaka type, and that's kind of it, you know? Like that's going to be available. There's great guys who just aren't coming to you. There's no way LaMarcus Aldridge or any of those guys are just going to, I'm cool. We don't want them anymore. You know?
And meanwhile, on top of all that, assuming you can find one of these guys and get them to commit and clear the cap space for them, you then have to worry about what kind of fit they're going to be on the team. And you know, will they get along with their teammates? Will they have a great relationship with Dwayne Casey, who's now your coach for the foreseeable future?
Right.
And none of that is guaranteed. And whatever flaws DeRozan comes with, you know some of the boxes that he does check off, which is, you know, a very valuable thing when you're looking at what you've got and what you still need.
Right.
Yeah, and there's familiarity there as well. We'll get to the NBA Finals, I think, before noon today, because I think it warrants a little more of a conversation than we have time for before the break. But, yeah, there's big question marks for this Raptors team in the offseason. I mean, they're good questions to have. You have a lot of assets.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at Masai Ujiri, he's got cap space, which might, I mean, dissolve quite a bit with some moves, and it doesn't take much to see the payroll go a little higher. But you got a top 10 pick. You got good young players. You have your own first-round pick. Like, there's a lot of different permutations that could result in the improving of this Raptors roster this offseason, and we're already talking about a team that made the Eastern Conference Final. When we come back, It's fun to talk about the Blue Jays again. It wasn't that way for a while. A lot of people jumping off the bandwagon, as they often do with slow starts in baseball, but that's the beauty of the major leagues of baseball. They play 162 of these things, and Blue Jays almost done this 12-game stretch against exclusively the Yankees and Red Sox, and they've done pretty darn well. Thank you very much. They've won 8 so far, and there's 2 more games to go. In Boston. We'll talk about the Blue Jays and their improved outlook in the American League East coming up next. I'm Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle, Jordan Heath Rawlings. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Craig Battle, I'm Ben Ennis. The Blue Jays started a string of 12 straight games where they play Yankees, Red Sox, in which the season really could have gone one of two directions. Or it could have, I mean, everything could have been the same. But there was the opportunity, if you really stunk up the joint against the team that still does lead the American League East, and the Yankees, who had played much better, were at 500 when the Blue Jays met them at Yankee Stadium. There was a belief that, oh boy, we could be already having discussions about tough decisions coming at the July 31st non-waiver trade deadline if this team is, you know, 10 games out of first by the end of this 12-game stretch. Well, hasn't exactly gone that way. The Blue Jays have only lost twice, and there's only 2 games left in this 12-game stretch. They won game 1 over the Red Sox on Friday. R.A. Dickey, the haters got to go back under their rocks for another day. And the Blue Jays find themselves 4 games over 500 for the first time this season and just 2.5 games back of first place in the American League East. So all's good, Jordan.
And they were 7 games out just a little over a week ago. And it looked like the Red Sox were hitting like nobody's business and the Blue Jays just couldn't put the bats together. And I mean, there were a few days when it looked like they were in danger of letting things slip away. But to their credit, the Blue Jays never wavered. I think when you hear them talk, They said they never lost that swagger. A lot of people were saying that they'd lost it, saying that the bats had gone silent and where was the team we saw last year. But they always believed that this would happen for them. And I think when you look at what they've done so far this year, with the starting pitching especially, the conditions were really ripe for a little run like this, because when you're pitching as well as they have, and to a certain extent it was unexpected, when you're pitching that well, and, you know, managing to hang around despite some really quiet bats, it really was just a matter of time. And I don't think they've even still reached their offensive ceiling, but you see the kind of damage they can do when the pitching and hitting both show up.
That's what's interesting for me about this, in the way that they haven't started hitting yet. The big guys in the lineup, Donaldson and Bautista, and Edwin's having a bit of a run here. But you've been sort of getting by off nice contributions from Saunders and Smoke and Barney and even Ezekiel Carrera when he comes in.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, they've scored 10 runs, 7 runs. They have an 8-run game during this stretch. You don't think about this, and they also have another 7-run game against the Yankees. You don't think about this team really having hit its offensive stride even still, right? Like, it's still, they're very much getting by with some great starting pitching. What has changed a little bit for this team is it seems that they have a better idea in the eighth inning when it comes to the bullpen usage. Now, it hasn't always been super easy and super clean and without worry. I mean, and that's the nature of baseball as well. But Joe Biagini has been an absolute revelation for this team in the eighth inning. And I know John Gibbons didn't feel all that comfortable in him getting all three outs at Fenway in game one of this three-game series on Friday. But he's now the guy. When Gavin Floyd's been the guy, and while the numbers are okay, he's given up some big home runs. Jesse Chavez was the guy, and notably Drew Storen was the guy to start the season. So now it's Joe Biagini, and he's done a fine job.
Well, for now. I mean, yeah. I don't think that anybody would say, like, Biagini is the guy, you but know, for the rest
even,
of the season. Nobody's challenging
even for,
him
for
right
now done it, you know, right? Like, there hasn't even been, like, a real solid stretch of games in which Gavin Floyd was really getting the job done in the eighth inning.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing, is I won't say that Joe Biagini has beaten out competition to get this position that he currently holds. Yeah, he's the only guy that hasn't massively screwed up so far. So he's the eighth inning guy by default. And it, as long as it keeps working, that's great. The other thing that I think has really helped them that we didn't touch on when we went to the bullpen is the bats might not have fully woken up, but late inning hits have been coming. You know, those seventh inning, eighth inning, add a couple of extra insurance runs on. And when you're talking about a bullpen that's been Roberto Osuna and maybe Joe Biagini aside, as inconsistent as the Blue Jays bullpen has been, that's the kind of thing that really can help you win a few of those games. I mean, you look at a bunch of the games out of the last eight that they've been winning, a lot of them were 2-1, 1-1, 3-1 games in the sixth and seventh inning, and the Blue Jays were able to add a few runs at the end. And that makes a big difference to guys like Biagini, who haven't pitched in this situation a lot, to go in with that cushion.
Well, look at Friday night's game. Like, how different does that game look without the Devin Travis 2-run home run?
I think they lose that game.
It's definitely a different feeling, and maybe you're getting six outs out of Roberto Osuna instead of the four that he was required to get.
And I mean, I don't think it's that big a surprise that did help this team once he came in. What's their record since he came back?
They've lost once. They've since lost Devin, once. Devin Travis returned.
MVP. Devin Travis for MVP. but no, I think that does help, having a guy at second that you trust to get a couple of hits for you, because Ryan Goins was not getting it done. But okay, so in the bullpen, how much do we trust Brett Cecil to bounce back the same way he did last season? Is that on anybody's radar?
Well, and that's a good question, because the guy, as much as I think he's a good reliever and probably very good, is he as good as the guy that did not allow an earned run like after Father's Day last year? He was unbelievable. Are we expecting that? No. Do the Blue Jays need that necessarily? I don't know if they need that either, because you look around outside of the Yankees, who have a great back end of the bullpen, even though Dylan Betances has taken a couple of losses in his last couple of outings. The Red Sox are kind of in a similar position as the Blue Jays. They have a lockdown closer in Craig Kimbrel, but getting to him has been a bit of an issue, especially with Carson Smith out for the season. Koji Uehara is 41. The Blue Jays hammer Junichi Tozawa. Like, you look around this division, as much as I like the Red Sox offense, there's definitely warts in that rotation and the same sort of warts in the bullpen. It's hard not to view the Blue Jays in a pretty positive light.
Listen, no bullpen is really going to look great in the AL East because there are three lineups that can crack anybody open. I mean, we've seen the Blue Jays crack open Betances and Kimbrel and Chapman.
Yep.
And, you know, I would not be shocked. Obviously, he's been lights out so far. But would you be that shocked if the top of this Red Sox lineup got to Roberto Osuna for a couple of runs sometime this year?
No.
Because or the Orioles, who are hitting almost as well as the Red Sox at this point, right? So you need a bullpen, and you try to put one together, and you try to have a lockdown guy at the end of it. But I think entering any game in the late innings in this division, you're always at risk. It doesn't matter who you've got.
As much as we were talking about maybe the early season struggles being a blip for the Blue Jays and them not really being a sub-500 team, that's not who they truly are. Where are they? Have they changed your perception? Is it the same? Like, is it you're still viewing this as a 162-game season, there's ebbs and flows, and that you're not really still learning all that much about this team, even as we are now into June being four games over 500? Like, has this 12-game stretch that we're now through, 10 of the 12 games, has it changed your opinion? I'll tell you before you can answer. One thing I'm starting to learn, and I think the rest of baseball is starting to learn, the Yankees stink. Like, the Yankees are not good. They cannot hit.
No, I think I'm with you on that one. I think I'm with the Yankees stinking take. But as far as the Blue Jays, I feel like it's still such a it's a bit of a strange season still to this point. You're not getting contributions from your guys who can hit. You still don't know what you're going to get from Troy Tulowitzki at this point. He's injured. Your bullpen's been bad, but your starters have been great. Like, I feel like there's a lot of sort of regressing to the mean to come at this point, both good and bad. And I don't know exactly where that leaves this team. Like, I could see them continuing this run. I could see them taking over first place in a couple of weeks. I could see them, you know, going on a bit of a losing streak after this. You know, I don't know exactly what this team is yet.
See, to me, this team is with a few surprises, almost exactly the team that we thought it would be going into the season. And the bats have taken a while to heat up, and they're currently heating up. The starting pitching has been a pleasant surprise, but you expect that not to be as dominant as it has been. But again, they have good players, and they should be good. And you know, I was on this show 4 weeks ago when everything was wrong in Blue Jay land, and I said, don't worry, you know, sometime in midsummer they'll be contending for the division and should be right up there in the wild card chase, and that's still where I expect to see them. Am I saying that this is going to be the 2015 team all over again, and they're going to the ALCS and they're going to flip bats and beat everybody? Who knows? But they've got a good offense that's reliable and proven, and their starting pitching has been better than expected, and they've got a lights out closer, so they can beat any team in this division.
At Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Jordan Heath Rawlings, Craig Battle, and I'm Ben Ennis. So talking about that starting pitching, and I just kind of made a flip comment at the beginning of this segment about the R.A. Dickey haters. He's a guy. I get it. It's frustrating. Even though he had a no-hitter going deep into that start against David Price
for
on
the
Friday.
For the second game in a row against the Red Sox, no hit through five innings.
Right. He did walk five, which is frustrating, but and he hit a guy. He's a knuckleballer. But I think, and if you don't believe that he's going to be the guy that he always is at the end of the season, then you need to give your head a shake. He is. Like, that's, and you know that going into the year, that yes, while start to start, it can be infuriating, the body of work, and you look back on it, it's well worth the ride, because especially when this offense is going as good as it can, like that guy, we talked about him, the number of innings and the 200-plus innings and the ERA around four, even though he has an ERA under four the last couple of years, being so, so valuable.
Well, this is what Ben Nicholson-Smith wrote on Sportsnet.ca going into the game last night. Just that, you know, it's tough to watch sometimes because he does everything that he did last night. But he's also a better than average starter that you can bank on to pitch more innings than the average starter. And Ben sort of took a look around the division and looked for other starters like that. And it's shocking how few of them there are.
The Red Sox would take him in a heartbeat, although they could have two knuckleballers in the rotation.
He'd be their number That'd two or nice. Three pitcher.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Steven Wright's been better than Dickey this year, but he'd probably slot in there at the three with Porcello or whatever. He's been the Blue Jays' worst starting pitcher, but still been very competent.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the thing with R.A. Dickey is that he's always sort of like he's playing against a, like the ghost version of R.A. Dickey that everybody thought they were going to get, the Cy Young winner. And then there he's also now with Noah Syndergaard lighting it up in New York. It's like, is he better than Noah Syndergaard right now? It's like, well, no, but that doesn't mean he's bad. And then I think the sort of polarizing nature of sports conversations, it's like, well, if he's not what we thought, then he's not anything at all. And I think that's really unfair. And moving sort of forward, especially we all know he starts slow. It didn't, like, you couldn't go anywhere in April without saying, like, well, yeah, R.A. Dickey's been bad, but he's bad to start every season.
This was his best April of the last few years as a Blue Jay, his best April.
Yeah. He starts slow. Like, we knew that going in. That wasn't surprising. And then so the fact that he's looking okay now shouldn't be surprising either. And, yeah, that you absolutely need that guy who eats innings, and the body of work that he produces is good, you know.
And in that Ben Nicholson-Smith story, he talked about the fact that when the weather warms up, knuckleball seems to move a little bit more, which is understandable. But yeah, that's a very R.A. Dickey type line.
And it was moving last night.
Oh yeah, like it was gave all up an unearned run because Josh Tolley had his 1,000th pass ball of the season.
You could see it just fluttering though, and I mean it's you see the gifts from back with his time with the Mets or his first years with the Jays, and you would see this ball kind of come in, and you'd see the hitter like stare at it, just doing. Mm-hmm. What the heck was that? Mm-hmm. And you saw that a bit last night, and you'll probably see it some more as the weather warms up.
He is kind of the whipping boy, it seems, though, with this Blue
Jays
team.
You got to have one.
Right, like, and is there any way for him to shake it, and is it the Syndergaard thing that holds him back, and the expectations and the Cy Young Award that he never really lived up to, despite the fact that he's a valuable guy, and the fact that it's a frustrating thing to watch, really, even in an outstanding start. Like yesterday with the 5 walks and the pass ball and the hit batsman. Like, he's just, I have a tough time ever seeing Blue Jays fans really talk about R.A. Dickey being a valuable guy.
I don't think it's going to happen. No, I agree with you. I don't see that unless, he has one of those Brett Cecil-like, hey, after Father's Day, R.A. Dickey has a Clayton Kershaw-like, sub-1 whip kind of thing, which isn't going to happen. Like, it just, Brett Cecil's run last year can't be repeated, and neither can R.A. Dickey suddenly turn into Clayton Kershaw, right?
R.A. Dickey had his Clayton Kershaw run. It was great. That's when we paid for him.
Exactly, yeah. So it's like he's 4 years older than that now. He's not quite the same pitcher, and, having a run like that is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So I don't, barring the fact that he becomes a completely different player or some miracle happens, I don't see that changing at all.
Well, this is almost heresy to say in the Toronto market right now, but if you actually look at the stats and how they've pitched so far this year, R.A. Dickey is not very different from Marcus Stroman in terms of ERA, innings pitched, even strikeouts, which Stroman is not super high on this year. He's been pitching to contact a lot more. I'm not making the argument that R.A. Dickey is a better pitcher 100%. Than Marcus Stroman, but their outputs have been remarkably similar, and nobody is getting all over Marcus Stroman and saying what an awful start he's having and how can he pull it together.
Right, and Marcus Stroman's been victimized a couple of times by leaving the bases loaded and then all three runners coming around to score, but he put those runners on base. I get that as well. I think, and listen, I don't think this is I fall victim to it as well, is that with a conventional pitcher, you can kind of tell what's happening, right? Like, you can see a guy tire or starting to lose the zone, and it's likely going to continue in a linear fashion. With R.A. Dickey, he could walk two and hit a guy like he did in the first inning and then bounce back and go 6 2/3 without giving up an earned run. It's just not only from a start-to-start basis, but like an inning-to-inning, pitch-to-pitch, you just have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, you don't know when the knuckleball leaves his hand.
Yeah.
You have zero idea where it's going to end up, and neither does Josh Tolley. So you're just sort of playing with fire the whole time. And, I mean, I think the way you give R.A. Dickey his due, as Ben said, is you look at the body of work at the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you watch an individual R.A. Dickey inning, if you took somebody who'd never seen him before and put them at a game, just watch this guy for one inning, you would get totally different impressions of him depending on when you showed up. He could be the best pitcher in the world. He could be a junk baller who deserves to be an A-ball.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. The Blue Jays will use his 200 innings at an ERA around 4 and a guy that stays off the disabled list as well. Mm-hmm. The Blue Jays haven't really had a devastating injury in the starting rotation, which hopefully not a devastating one is coming, but generally few teams go through the whole season with just 5 starters. We've seen Drew Hutchison once, but
it's interesting because Drew Hutchison is pitching terrifically.
Yeah.
Down
and he's
in
not
Buffalo.
The only
and
one. Down.
Arden Zwelling went down to see him this week and, you know, talked to him and came away with his impression of obviously he would like to be here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's good for him to be putting in innings and really working against full lineups. And he's ready. You know, he's striking out more than a batter an inning. His control seems to be working, which was the big problem last time he was there. So, you know, obviously as much as you would not like to see an injury in the starting rotation, the Blue Jays actually appear to have a really solid option ready to go.
And they got another major league arm down there as well in Wade LeBlanc, who's pitched really well. Yeah, they have options.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of, like a sixth starter sort of thing, like they have, it seems like to me, more options than other starting rotations at this point. You know, like Gavin Floyd almost got there. Jesse Chavez is a guy. They've got a lot of backup at that position, and the fact that they haven't had an injury to this point yet is pretty great, but they're able to you know, bounce back from it, I'd say.
I mean, their sixth starter right now is the guy who started opening day for them in Yankee Stadium last year.
Yep. It's pretty crazy to talk about, but the Blue Jays have been very good when it comes to their starters. They've also, in talking about this 12-game stretch, been very good at getting to some of the elite relievers in this division, guys that they're going to see a lot, and some guys that they'd never seen before. Craig Kimbrell, new to the American League East. Aroldis Chapman, new to the American League East. And, in fact, Blue Jays, in the two times they faced Chapman, I've gotten to him twice. Both times they got to him. Once when he was a member of the Cincinnati Reds, I think it was 2013, they had an 8-run comeback in Cincinnati, and it was capped with an inning against Chapman. Is there any extra added importance of getting to these guys early in the season like they have, who come into games with a mystique, who throw upper 90s, who people around baseball talk about them being untouchable, unhittable, that the Blue Jays, with not even like the middle of the lineup bats, we're talking about Devin Travis and Darwin Barney getting to some of these good relievers. Is there added value in getting rid of some of that mystique early in the season?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely. The type of a bat that you have towards the end of the season against one of these guys, if you can think back on both for a strategic point of view, what works, what are they doing, that's great. But also just in terms of a confidence thing, heading into you see it the last couple of seasons with the Kansas City Royals bullpen and just sort of heading into it. And then the feeling of dread you get as a fan, I think, teams have this sort of same thing where it's like, ooh, you know, once we have to face these three guys at the tail end of this game, we need to get a lead early. And if we don't get that early lead, then we're stuck. Then the game's over and we're facing an elimination kind of thing. I think the team, if they can get a couple of those, if they can beat the Chapmans and if they can get to Andrew Miller, that kind of thing, I think that definitely bodes well for the end of the season.
And it's like Ben said, you know, it's the way that they've been doing it. I think, you know, obviously it does wonders for the Blue Jays' confidence, and that's great. But it also hurts the confidence of some of these elite-level relievers. Like, I promise you that Aroldis Chapman is not expecting Darwin Barney to get to him. He's not expecting these 6, 7, 8, 9 hitters to hang around and make him throw 12 pitches and, you know, dink a couple into right field and scratch out a couple of hits. And before you know it, you know, he's coughed up a game. That's not something that Aroldis Chapman does. And if he does it, he especially does not do it against the Darwin Barneys of the world. So that, you know, when you're facing a division rival like that, who you will see down the stretch, to put that in their heads as well and put it in Joe Girardi's head when he's wondering, like, well, maybe I should let my starter stay in for an extra inning because last time I went to Betances in the sixth or seventh, they knocked him around a bit. So it's not, the game's not over when I go to my bullpen. So maybe I will leave Tanaka in for the seventh. You know, those are the kind of decisions you want to make the other team make.
You know, it was interesting in that Friday game is, and it shouldn't be interesting. I mean, it's not in other ballparks, but at Fenway, and for a first-place team, how many Blue Jays fans were there? And you could hear the "Let's go Blue Jays" chant. You see it all the time in Seattle, of course. And you saw it all in all four games in Minnesota because it's so close to the Canadian mm-hmm. border. You see it a lot in border cities. But
you'll see it in Detroit next series.
Oh, you'll
sure.
see a ton of people make the trip down to Detroit to see the Blue Jays and Tigers. This team, we wondered how sustainable the leap in attendance late last season was. Blue Jays ranked 7th in the Major Leagues of Baseball in attendance, home attendance so far this season, averaging over 36,000, which is, and I know it's hard to compare apples to oranges when you're looking at the capacity of Fenway, but that's Blue Jays are 7th, the Red Sox are 8th, right? So that's certainly percentage-wise, the Red Sox are getting that building filled more often than not. But right there, Angels, Cubs, the Yankees, like the Blue Jays for a long time were sitting 15 through 20 in Major League Baseball in attendance. And certainly I thought there might be a risk of some drop-off if the mediocre play from early this season, the lack of run scoring continued through the rest of the season. That's a pretty encouraging number to me, to see the 36,000-plus showing up at Rogers Center and to seeing the sustained road fan support that this team gets this year. It seemed like, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, this is different than 2 years ago, that last year's late season and postseason run has made it an impact.
Well, I think absolutely. When I first got to the city in 2003, I'd go to, you know, Cheap Tuesday where the tickets were $2 and I'd be one of 15 people in the stands. You know, I'm exaggerating, but there was a lot of years where it seemed like, yeah, like the 15 to 20 zone was way high for them, that they were, you know, you were having Chicago White Sox beat reporters come up and say that baseball is dead in Canada. We should move this franchise to Mexico, that sort of thing. And then so the stark, you know, obviously things change when you start to, you know, push for the playoffs and you get some marquee players, and last year's run was fantastic. But to see this fan base sort of turn around and sort of pull back, especially after the offseason where you lose David Price and Anthopoulos leaves and stuff like that, and seemed like some fans were, you know, generally upset just after the season's over, it wouldn't have been surprising to me. But no, they're traveling with the team. They're coming out in droves. You're getting sellouts more often than not. Yeah, for a Friday night game in the city, if it's in home, it's packed.
It's really exciting to see, too. And you see Blue Jays players themselves talking about it, which to me is the best part of it. When Jason Grilly came over here, came in for his first thing, threw the ball in the outfield before he'd even thrown a pitch, which whatever. But they talked to him after the game, and he said, you know, Russell Martin, who he knows very well, had told me about it and told me what this atmosphere was going to be like. And then I got out here, and you know, this is early June game. Like, I didn't expect it to be like this, but it is. And I mean, that to me is the thing. Canadians, when they get behind a team, I think it's a really impressive thing to see. You know, it doesn't happen all that often, but there's something coalescing around this team. And to me, the biggest part of it, beyond simply the success, is that it's an exciting team to watch. You're going to see home runs. You've got some guys who can strike people out. You've got amazing defensive players in Kevin Pillar, Tulowitzki when he's healthy, Ryan Goins. Josh Donaldson is always getting dirty. You know, they give you full value. If you buy a Blue Jays ticket, you get full value in terms of, like, seeing the athletes on display, you know?
Unless Josh Donaldson's ejected in the first inning, which has happened once this season. And, yeah, tough for those fans who made the trip to Minnesota to see that game. But Josh bounced back very much the next day. Blue Jays giving their fans plenty to cheer about so far during this 12-game stretch against the Yankees and Red Sox. Of course, the news of the day, the news of the weekend, news of the year, passing of Muhammad Ali at the age of 74. We'll be all over it on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on our flagship station, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, this weekend. But who better to encapsulate the life of one of the legends in North American sports and North American culture than Stephen Brunt?
Ali making the clinch. Ali setting himself to try for a knockout. They're putting everything into this.
He was a dangerous man. Inside the ring and outside the ring. And really, there's no higher compliment that can be paid to Muhammad Ali. Though that edge was lost in his last years, as he was physically diminished, softened and sentimentalized in the public eye, transformed into a benign, silent saint, especially among those who weren't alive during those tumultuous times when Ali stood at the eye of the storm.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi. Sold I to the merchant ships.
Remembering what he was and what he meant, that's where the story has to begin. With the smile, certainly, and with the poetry and the patter and the charm, but understanding that so much of what the world came to admire about Ali was born out of unease, born out of painful change, and for some, born out of hatred. To suggest otherwise is to diminish why Muhammad Ali matters.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
He didn't look the way a heavyweight champion was supposed to look. The model, still fresh in memory when Cassius Clay arrived on the scene in the early 1960s, was Joe Louis, who did everything perfectly, by the book. You couldn't dance around like that. You couldn't punch effectively going backwards. You couldn't avoid shots by pulling back your head with your hands held low. You couldn't. But Ali could. And he didn't sound the way a heavyweight champion was supposed to sound, especially an African-American heavyweight champion. That was Joe Louis, too. Deferential, humble, respectful. That was Floyd Patterson, a beacon of tolerance for the civil rights movement, for the integrationists. You couldn't boast about your talent. You couldn't predict a round of your opponent's demise or mock them in front of the cameras. You couldn't advocate racial separation and defy your own government during wartime. You couldn't. But Ali did.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time.
It was the conversion that changed the conversation. Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight champion of the world, affiliated with a group that spoke of white-skinned, blue-eyed devils, of spaceships circling the Earth, waiting to attack. And when confronted, when challenged, the members of the Nation of Islam didn't smile, and they didn't blink. Ali wasn't the clown prince anymore. What he said when his draft status changed, when he believed he was going to Vietnam, was in part a reflection of his religious beliefs, though it really wasn't that much different than what thousands of other young Americans thought and said, faced with the same predicament. Why me? What are we fighting for? Is it really my country, right or wrong, even if it means dying for no good reason? I ain't got nothing against them Viet Cong.
Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind.
But he wasn't just anyone. He held the most prestigious title in sport. They'd follow his lead. That was the risk. They'd listen to him, be emboldened by him. And so, Muhammad Ali had to be brought to heel. In the beginning, only the United States Constitution and a few brave souls were on his side. By the end of his exile, the world had changed, and Ali had something to do with that.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs.
He didn't know the storybook finish was coming. He didn't know that he would come back, that he would reclaim his title, that he would overcome George Foreman and Zaire. He didn't know he would survive the three titanic battles with his nemesis, Joe Frazier, that he would fight on and on to his physical detriment. He thought he was going to jail. He didn't know that years later, he would stand high above the Olympic Stadium in Atlanta, trying to calm his trembling hand, that by then, so much of that hatred had been transformed into love. Love because they finally understood he was right, or at least had the right to stand up for his beliefs. Or love made easier because he no longer threatened the status quo. Or love born of pathos and sentimentality and generational nostalgia. Truth is, that was all part of the mix.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
You'd like to think Ali paved the way, and he did, though mostly for a bunch of pale imitations who could only, and only sort of, talk the talk. For international sports icons who wouldn't voice a controversial opinion on anything, lest it cost them the chance to sell more shoes, let alone put their careers on the line. The truth is, in every way that matters, Muhammad Ali stood alone. Sui generis, nonpareil, a one-off. And yes, just like he said, the greatest.
It's all I ever had, redemption songs, these songs of freedom.
That again, Stephen Brunt, Muhammad Ali dead at the age of 74 on Friday. When we come back, going to get into the NBA Finals and LeBron James trying to bounce back after Game 1 in Oakland against the Warriors. And what's going on with the Stanley Cup Finals? Because the numbers are pretty good. It just seems that in Toronto, the focus is so far away from hockey right now. We'll get into that and plenty more coming up. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Craig Battle. It's the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Ryan Dixon.
Don Granato has seen some enormously talented young hockey players in his day, but the former U.S. National Team Development Program coach says they can all get in line behind future Toronto Maple Leaf Austin Matthews.
His drive to compete to win is completely different than anybody else has ever coached.
That ambition, combined with a sublime skill set, has Matthews in line to be the first overall pick when the Leafs kick off the 2016 NHL draft later this month. The 6'2" center showed extremely well, facing men all year in Switzerland, then played a lead role for Team USA at the World Championship in May. And while much of what Matthews can do is evident to anyone watching, it takes a trained eye of an NHL vet like Nick Foligno to catch it all.
He does the little things. The way he prepares, first of all, for a game is unlike any 18-year-old I've seen. But also just the things he does throughout the game. The little plays that maybe don't go noticed, like you said, in the defensive zone. And he's a guy that you can say he plays all three zones really well.
Conclusion, Matthews is the whole package. And if all goes according to plan, Toronto fans will get their best gift in decades when he starts skating for the team next fall.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine. Available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Craig Battle and Jordan Heath Rawlings. Cleveland Cavaliers lose Game 1 of the NBA Finals 104-89 in Oakland to the Warriors. It's a close game headed into that fourth quarter in which the Warriors outscored the Cavs 30-21. Not much of a game for either Steph Curry or Klay Thompson. They were 8 of 27 combined for just 20 points. And part of that, you got to figure, was game planning by the Cavaliers, trying to take those two guys away. Bench pieces did their part. LeBron James, though, when he loses Game 1, which he is, he's wont to do on occasion, like, Craig, generally they bounce back in a big way in Game 2 of those series. So I by no means am writing off LeBron James and the Cavaliers after Game 1 on Thursday.
Not at all. I mean, That game couldn't have been weirder if they played it on the moon.
It would have been a little weirder.
I don't think so. The Cavs had wide open layups that they missed. LeBron turned the ball over, according to the box score, 4 times. I counted like 8, 9. Like it was a weird game. There was nothing called whatsoever within like 6, 7 feet of the hoop. So I don't know. I see this next game playing out a lot different. I don't see Curry and Klay Thompson missing as many shots, but I don't see the supporting cast making as many shots. Cleveland got nothing at all from its bench. Golden State's bench could not have possibly been better. There's just so much. Like Kyrie Irving, He wasn't moving off the ball at all. He was basically giving no bailouts. He wound up shooting like less than 33%. He led the Cavs in scoring with 26, but it wasn't a good game for him. There was a lot of isolation. Like, I feel like there's going to be adjustments galore on both sides. We'll see a completely different game, and I honestly think it could go either way.
Yeah, it's certainly a situation where the Warriors, and understandably so, are the heavy favorites headed into this one, and the Cavaliers at times have shown to be a dominant team. It's just hard, Jordan, when you're talking about like the litmus test and the ringer that they've had to go through. Like, there was no incredible 3-1 comeback against the Thunder for the Cavs, and certainly like the Raptors did a nice job pushing them to at least 6 games, but in the losses, those were crushing defeats by the Cavaliers, most of them on the road in Cleveland, of course, for the Raptors, just the game 6 win for the Cavs. It just feels like the Warriors have been way more tested this postseason.
Yeah, I mean, in almost any year in the NBA, at least in recent memory, the team coming out of the West is going to be more tested just because of the nature of the league. You know, and you can make the argument for that either way. The Cavs are probably a lot more rested and a lot less exhausted than the Warriors are. But off of game one, I think you can take a couple things out of that. And you saw a similar thing happen to the Cavs that you saw happen when they lost a couple of games to the Raptors. They're a team that relies on making outside shots in order to build big advantages and to put a team in a big enough hole that it plays into their game. And I think they shot less than 33% from three in game one. And, you know, that's way under their playoff percentage. And when they're not hitting those shots, they're vulnerable because they don't have, beyond LeBron James, who obviously can get to the basket anytime he wants, basically, they don't have a lot of players who bully their way into the paint and can score that way when shots aren't falling. So I think that's the fundamental difference, obviously, between these two teams. And whoever between Golden State's two superstars and Cleveland's cast of supporting outside shooters, whoever shoots better from that group is going to be the overwhelming favorite to me.
Yeah, I mean, the Cavs got 10 points off their bench. Channing Frye, who had been, like, you know, getting a lot of plaudits for being the kind of stretch four that a lot of teams were looking for prior to the trade deadline. He was a total afterthought, and he was doing a lot. A total matchup nightmare for the three teams the Cavs played in the playoffs until this point. He only played 7 minutes, took one shot, missed it. So I could see both the rotation switching up, and I could see them just sort of focusing back on ball movement, getting the ball, like driving it in, kicking it out, finding guys in open spots, guys getting to those open spots. They were just doing a ton of standing around, and I'm not sure why that was, but it was certainly by design. They were getting post-ups for Love, post-ups for LeBron, and everybody else was just sort of chilling, hanging out. And that wasn't the team that we saw. The team that blew the doors off the Raptors in those 4 wins, they were moving. Like, they were playing hard D. They were active on offense, active on defense. That the team the other night was doing a lot of standing around, uncharacteristically so, in this playoffs.
I mean, and maybe it's because your first thought when you see the matchup of the two teams goes to, okay, well, you don't want to get Golden State running and gunning and just taking you apart like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe what you're trying to do then is sort of slow the game down, make every possession count, and outwork them that way. But, I mean, in order to do that, you still have to have people moving without the ball when you're running a set offense, which they really weren't doing. And if you're not going to do that, unless all your shots are falling, you don't have much of a chance.
No. And I mean, for the Warriors right now, we talk a lot about the Cavs. Their confidence has to be sky high. They weathered a storm of terrible games out of their two stars. But, you know, Draymond Green came through with almost a triple-double. It was kind of a quiet night. I don't really remember focusing on him, given all the other things that were going on, but he had a great game. And then all their backups stepped up like crazy. So they got, you know, good performances at Harrison Barnes and Sean Livingston and the rest of that cast. So they have to be hyper confident heading into this thing, because, you know, DeRozan in the Raptors playoffs kept saying, you know, I'm not going to go 5 of 19 again. And he kind of did. But you're not going to expect Curry and Klay Thompson to shoot this poorly the rest of the series.
Game 2 of that NBA Finals going on Sunday. Saturday night, 8 o'clock CBC, Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Final. We don't have a ton of time to talk about it. In fact, we have very little time to talk about it. But it's an interesting matchup. And I know the ratings have been good on TV, but it's just, maybe it's hard for people in this city, Jordan, to get that ginned up about hockey right now because they've been punched in the gut for 82 games generally in watching the Maple Leafs this season.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing is that they weren't watching 82 games of the Maple Leafs this season because most Maple Leaf fans, at least the ones that I know, and I know quite a few, tuned out around, January, February, when it became clear that the worst thing that could happen to this team would be an end-of-season winning streak to pull them out of that draft slot. And I think Leaf fans, for the most part, were content to sort of move on from hockey and focusing on their great basketball team and their great baseball team that was coming back. And there's only so much room. There's only so many times you can say, honey, I got to watch this game tonight, you know, and
pushing the limits.
Yeah, me too. We're all pushing the limits. But when you when you're talking about a Leafs team that's not doing much, you sort of tune out of hockey. And once you tune out of hockey and the weather gets nice at the same time, it's tough to tune back in. I think the rest of Canada, where hockey is a religion, is still doing just fine. And it's a compelling matchup. But in Toronto, there's just so much going on.
Yeah, it'll be a different situation, you'd imagine, next season, even if the Leafs are no good with Austin Matthews and some of the younger players. That'll do it. For Craig Battle and Jordan Heath Rawlings, I'm Ben Annis. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
I have wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.